When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Ben Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 10, Halloween.
Ooh,
man. In the real world here, as we're recording this, it's like 1 week after actual Halloween.
I know. Literally, as I was looking at our slate, I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to hit the Halloween episode on Halloween, and then we'll hit the Christmas episode on Christmas, and it's going to be so great. And then I just did my week math wrong, and in fact, we missed Halloween by 1 week. But either
your
which
week
way,
math is weak.
My week math is, yeah, incredibly
yeah,
weak.
That's what I'm hearing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Unlike this chapter, which I will say, as I cracked into Biggin. It, I got in through the first few pages, and I was like, man, I don't know if there's just something like off about my like the way I'm like listening today or like reading today, but like I don't have like a lot of like notes or marks that I'm putting down. And then I got past the first three pages, and I mean, it's just like obliterated.
I had like the same thing. I was like, man, maybe not as much is happening. It's just like we're sort of explaining the rules to Quidditch here. I guess, you know, that's just pretty straightforward. That just has to be there.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's that. Actually, it was sort of funny. Last night, I don't know if I've mentioned it on this podcast yet, but I've started reading my son this exact book. My oldest son, Luke.
I cannot believe that you timed it out such that, yeah, while we're doing this particular podcast, you're also giving it like a read through to your son for the first time.
It just sort of worked out. I wasn't really sure. I wasn't like planning like, okay, I am counting down the days. Luke is officially ready. But like we have a bunch of different copies of the like books at my house. And like he knows that some of them are his because once upon a time, you and I got invited to London to like host the thing for Pottermore.
We did. We got to be on the front page of Pottermore one day, which was amazing and like, you know, like a bucket list item check.
So cool. But while we were there, they took us to like all of the Harry Potter stops like around London, including platform 9 3/4. And at this point, Luke was like 6 weeks old or something. He had like just been born. So he was very fresh. But like, you know, me and Beth were, you know, chatting. I was like, no, you have to go to London. You know, if Google and Pottermore are asking you to do something, you probably have to do that.
Yeah.
So we did the trip. And while we were at platform 9 3/4, I was like, oh my gosh, I can buy Luke his very first Harry Potter book ever from the store, the platform 9 3/4 in London.
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah, so
you actually have an amazing vlog where you talk about this exact thing. It's very emotional.
Yeah, so if you want to see me get really emotional about buying Luke his first book, or if you want to see me even more emotional reading this book, you could just watch me read it to him because, oh my gosh, I get to certain passages and I'm like, I can't, this is hard. Oh my God, this is such a big moment. Oh, wow. Oh, she's sharing this with Luke right now. Oh gosh.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I think the number one thing, when expecting our daughter Addison was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get to read her the books one day.
So. I know. Yeah. Good luck with that. When we were there, it was also the 20th anniversary of, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is part of why we were there.
Yes.
I think, so they had these 20th anniversary books out, which come in like different house varieties. So you can buy like the Gryffindor set of books or the Hufflepuff set of books. And I suddenly was like faced with trying to choose which house book was going to be Luke's first one.
Right.
And it was like, I was like, I stood in that store for like 30 minutes, like not knowing what to do, and finally settled on the Gryffindor set of books because he had come out of the NICU, and I was like, he's so brave. He's so brave. So that's his very first Harry Potter book, and that's the one we're reading to him now. But as it were, last night I just read him chapter 9, and so tonight we'll be reading chapter 10. So I was like, I'm going to read this chapter twice today.
How about that? That's amazing. That is amazing. Yeah. But yeah, so as we said, I mean, Halloween's rather interesting within the wonderful wizarding world because it is known to be a rather eventful occasion for Harry and company.
It is. There's almost always something happens on Halloween, which is like notable because it is also the date on which Voldemort attacked Harry as a baby.
Right. And so you almost wonder if it's like a mildly cursed.
Yeah.
Cursed
like is there a cursedness about it? Like in the same way that like the Defense Against the Dark Arts position is cursed.
Right. Yeah. 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 That's a good question because eventually we'll see. I think like the Nearly Headless Nick's Death Day party will be on this occasion. Does Sirius Black enter the castle in
Sirius Black does, yeah, break into the castle on book three. On book four is when Harry's name comes out of the Goblet of Fire.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's like, what's interesting about that is that the Sirius one is like the complete opposite. Like Sirius is like one of Harry's greatest allies, but the other, at least for the first four books, all the other ones are like almost Voldemort direct related incidents.
Yes, they absolutely are. Yeah,
which is kind of fascinating. Yeah. So anyway, without any further ado, let's dive on into chapter 10, Halloween, where we're sort of coming on the heels of the midnight duel, where Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Neville have just sort of like ventured out into the castle in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. You're sort of getting a feel for like the different ways in which the different characters might react to such, you know, rule breaking, if you will. Obviously Hermione takes it incredibly difficult and sort of like, you know, you start to see the even greater valley being forged between Harry and Ron and their relationship with Hermione, which obviously will yet to be filled in this same chapter. But obviously that's a really big one. Neville himself also is sort of continuing to demonstrate like a little bit more of his overall
just maybe cowardice.
Like like a little bit. You know, like I don't think he's really stepped into.
Not quite. He's very much like, I didn't want to be there. The entire experience was the worst. And I don't like dogs.
Yeah, it's like I'm not even remotely curious what that dog is guarding. It's right. Like, whatever it is, totally fine. Keep on guarding it.
Meanwhile, Harry and Ron are like, let's do it again. Let's have another wild adventure. That was the coolest thing ever.
Yep. Yeah. So they're all jazzed about it. Then, of course, shortly thereafter, you know, they go down to the Great Hall for breakfast, where the arrival of a large parcel being carried by no fewer than, is it six screech owls?
Yeah,
which will of course be Harry's Nimbus 2000.
Oh yeah,
along with a letter, which, you know, the letter almost, it feels like they could have like sent him a letter and been like, hey, can you come by my office later?
It does
today?
Seem like this was not the way to do it.
Yes, yeah, especially because here's the other thing too. It's like, you know, do not open the parcel at the table. It contains your new Nimbus 2000, but I don't want everybody like knowing you got a broomstick, or they'll all want one. This is like one of those things where it's like, this is not really a secret that needs to be kept necessarily. Like the word is starting to get out anyway. And also like the very thing that they're bending the rules for is a school wide and attended event, which is Quidditch.
Right.
So like people are going to know Harry was,
has a broomstick.
He's breaking the first year rule and also is on the Quidditch team. So it's
it's like it seems like maybe what they don't want them to know is that like the school bought him the broomstick, but then absolutely, yeah, just should have been like, Potter, could you stay behind after Transfiguration?
You know, like, this is like an interesting one though to me though as well, because like and I wrote some notes down here because like when McGonagall takes Harry to talk to Oliver after catching the Remember All in the first place, Oliver just sort of like offhandedly is like, Professor, we'll have to get him a broom, you know, like as if this is just something that like Quidditch captains can sort of like dictate.
Yeah.
But like the fact that it's not just any broom, it's like, you know, currently the best broom that happens to be on the market, and that it's specifically from McGonagall. Like I have mixed feelings about it in every which direction, because what I almost want to be the case here is that like McGonagall, who is a famously stern character, I sort of just like the idea that like maybe she's got like, you know, a little bit of empathy for both like Harry's circumstances, her own remembrance of like his parents, maybe some like appreciation for the role that he played in the downfall of like Voldemort. Like, I almost like to think that this is just quite literally a kind moment being demonstrated on behalf of one Minerva McGonagall.
Yeah, not just outright favoritism,
which, I mean, certainly on some level it feels like it is. Like, even the fact that there are school brooms, it's like I it's kind of like, it feels like if there are just school brooms, and it seems like in other instances Harry is required to fly a school broom when I think his Nimbus has been destroyed. Maybe he's received the Firebolt.
Yeah, but like, hasn't been allowed, cleared to play. So has to practice with the school brooms.
Yeah. Which was like
there was an option, and they were like, no. Those won't be good enough for. We can't let one of the actual players ride on one of the school brooms unless they don't have their own, and our rules don't work.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I mean, there's something that I always really enjoy about a character who is notoriously like kind of stiff in nature, but has like a kind or like gooey moment a little bit. So anyway, that's sort of what I'd like to think happens here.
Yeah.
It's my own personal headcanon.
Yeah. But also the even being wrapped up as a broomstick doesn't seem like it fools anybody for even one hot second. Malfoy immediately is like, that's a broomstick.
Yeah. And basically cuts him off like the moment he leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like,
and it's not only that, this is the second time in what, 2.5 pages that Malfoy has been like convinced Harry is about to get kicked out of school. But like, I don't think I have noticed before, just like listening through, the absolute obsession Malfoy has with Harry in the first year.
There, like, can be no doubt.
It is like consuming all of his thoughts. Like, I love the opening sentence of this chapter too. It's just that Malfoy couldn't believe his eyes when he saw Harry and Ron were still at Hogwarts the next day, looking tired but perfectly cheerful. Like, in his mind, he has just like oust, like his goal was to oust Harry from Hogwarts and effectively the entire wizarding world by tricking him out of bed one night.
One time.
Like, this is 11-year-old Malfoy's plan. He's like, I'm going to just defeat Harry Potter right now. I'm going to get him out of bed and that's it. That'll be the end of him forever.
But here's the thing too, is that it's like, I think that what's happening is something that you can witness in a lot of like early like relationships as well. Like, you know, as you're sort of like going through your early, you know, foundational years and kind of like having those first like crushes or whatever the case may be, but like rejection, not that Malfoy necessarily has a crush on Harry, but I mean,
he doesn't not, Ben.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like he certainly is taking notice of him. But I think that what's happening here, you know, is that Malfoy has extended that hand in friendship, which you know, Harry basically was like, no. And so I think that like it doesn't necessarily surprise me, because like, you know, that sense or feeling of rejection can oftentimes lead to this sense of like need to prove oneself in some other, you know, mm-hmm. capacity.
Well, it's not only was he rejected by Harry, but Harry is effectively filling the role he thought he would have at school. And if Harry wasn't there this year, he pretty much would have that role.
We've said it over and over again. Yeah, it's hilarious, because it's like, you know, we always see Malfoy as the adversary to Harry, but Malfoy seems to be pretty universally liked by just about everybody else who like, it doesn't seem like Malfoy deals with the struggles that you might expect from somebody that is obviously just being a bully all the time.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's almost much more like he's like the super popular kid who's decided, like, I mean, this is James Potter's dislike of Snape.
Right.
You know, it's like people didn't dislike James Potter for his distaste of Snape. You know, that he was still renowned. He was still
Such an interesting comparison. Like, James is to Snape as Draco is to Harry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, otherwise, yeah, it's like no one remembers James Potter as like some bad guy at school.
Right. No, yeah. Not at all.
I mean, Draco exactly. does become a Death Eater, so there's that.
There's that, but yeah. I mean, he eventually comes around. He doesn't get quite that. He doesn't get the. I mean, we'll talk about it way, 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 way more in Deathly Hallows. He doesn't get quite the redemption arc I would have preferred.
I would agree with that.
Doesn't matter. So as we move forward here, though, there's you know, Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle kind of like pin Harry and Ron back. They discover the Nimbus, which, you know, it's kind of interesting to me. They like literally like snatch it from his hands and then throw it back. I'm like, this feels like one of those instances where it's just like the remember all over again. Like, I've got your broomstick, Potter. Now I'll see you later.
Yeah.
I got my two big games with me. You can't have it back. But then, you know, even Flitwick's arrival, you know, is sort of like an interesting neutral party here as like, you know, head of Ravenclaw House.
Right. Because
he's just sort of like, oh, yes, of course. I know about the situation entirely, like, you yeah. know, it's like
we all had a little good laugh about it. Of course, we'll break the rules for Harry.
For him, he saved all of wizard kind.
I know. What would it have been like if Snape had been the one to stumble onto them here, like Potter?
Oh, I know. Yeah. I mean, especially with the first match of the season being against Slytherin, right? Like,
right.
You know, so it's. I mean, it feels like the type of thing where McGonagall and Snape's rivalry. It almost feels to me like Snape would just be like, you're not supposed to have that, breaking the rules again, as I expected. Which also, you know, wouldn't totally surprise me if McGonagall like is quietly trying to keep it a secret so that Snape doesn't know.
I know, but like clearly if Flitwick knows, then Snape must know.
Must know. Yeah,
right.
Almost certainly.
Also, they Malfoy's personal broom is revealed to have been a Comet 260.
Yes.
Which is just a fun inclusion here because Ron has like an interesting relationship with hating this broom this is also the broom that Cho is later riding.
Okay.
Whenever she gets introduced to the story, she rides a Comet 260 as well. And Ron is all like on her about like being a fair weather fan for the tornadoes.
Yeah.
He's just like, what? No, everyone just likes them now because they're good. And it's like whoever rides the Comet 260, Ron's a little like, what is this? What? No,
But I like the fact that they specifically say comets look flashy, but they're not in the same league as the Nimbus. It's like, I feel like this is almost like car guys that I've known throughout my life. I feel like there is something to this kind of thing, like, you know, cars that might look fast, but aren't fast, but then like, you know, then like a true gearhead knows like, oh no, he's like, this is a car to appreciate because like underneath that hood, like it's a sleeper, you know,
yeah,
that thing can go
now. That is absolutely true, but also on that same note, Harry like one paragraph later is like, I have no idea what brooms are, but this looks nice.
That's a good point. Speaking of, as we're getting the description of the Nimbus, it says, let's see here, it looked wonderful, sleek and shiny with a mahogany handle and a long tail of neat straight twigs and Nimbus 2000 written in gold near the top. One of the things I find kind of interesting about this in particular, and the wood in particular, is that it's mahogany, which is the same as James's wand.
Ooh, yeah.
Which is kind of a fun detail because I feel like Harry's affinity and knack for Quidditch is sort of like reflected through like his like, you know, skill inheritance from his father a little bit. So it feels like a little bit of like a nod there to that. Just another side note from reflecting on the movies. I always kind of felt like this maybe goes against literally the exact gearhead comment I just made, but the Nimbus always looks the way I feel like the Firebolt is supposed to look.
Yes.
In the films. And then the Firebolt comes out and it's sort of got like a much more almost like off-road, rugged, scraggly appearance.
Yeah, know? Like the end of it looks like it's been going so fast that the bristles are just like sort of blown out looking.
Yeah.
Where it's like, but that is not at all how it is described in the book, where it's supposed to be like extremely sleek, extremely fast, like each twig hand-picked, and it's like it doesn't look aerodynamic.
No, it looks like closer to a broom, but the Nimbus looks like an aerodynamic broom.
It's
like, from the moment I remember seeing that as a kid growing up, it was sort of like it sort of took this notion that I had in my head of like witches flying brooms in like Halloween posters.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of being this like silly sort of like, you know, I always imagined like a broomstick, like your classic like straw bottom with wooden handle,
right?
Like, that you'd find in like an actual household broom cupboard. And they showed us the Nimbus and it was like, dang,
it's a vehicle.
Like,
yeah,
now that thing is cool looking, and to this day I've always sort of coveted one. So
I agree. I think the way they made the Nimbus look in the first two movies is amazing, and I think the way the Firebolt looks is dumb. And like they also added like the footrests on the fire on the firebolt, which I am so anti footrests on broomsticks.
Yeah,
like I think it is so. It looks like they put training wheels on the broom. Like it's like okay, but you took those off after they turned like four, right? Okay,
that's like a kickstand.
That's like a kickstand for your broom.
Right, right.
Also, they abandoned the entire thing. We were supposed to be like up to make the brooms fly up. Like,
oh, right.
You
right,
know, yeah. Like that is never a thing again. That's like just the first time they ever ride them.
Well, it does seem kind of silly unless there would be a situation where everybody's broomstick was already on the pitch, but I feel like they always show it to us with all the characters carrying them out there. So it'd be like hilarious if you like watch them all walk out, set the broomstick on the ground just so they could then summon it back into their
hand
to take off. But I feel like I could actually see a world where you like line up similar to like a soccer match. Everybody's like, you know, roughly in their position and all the broomsticks are like laid out before them, and it's sort of like part of the strategic configuration as to how each team kicks off the match. It's like everybody's broomsticks start on the ground.
Oh right, yeah. You know, like you have to like get it off the ground and kick off.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's like the tip off in basketball or something. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, there's like a little bit of, you know, the tip off can kind of go either way. It's like the athletic coin flip, you know,
right,
so to speak. Mm-hmm. Which maybe anybody who plays basketball is like, that is not a coin flip at all. And there's a ton of skill involved with having your best jumper or tallest.
I'm sure there is. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. I mean,
get it to your point guard right away.
people consider this. This is not like just, not total chance, but either which way. Yeah, we sort of get like a little bit of the introduction, you know, a little bit more to Oliver Wood, who, again, as a kid, was a character that I always just like endeared. I always loved Oliver Wood.
Oliver Wood is great, and then his character in the movies is even like better. They're like this kid with the Irish accent, and I feel like every girl I knew ever had a crush on Oliver Wood.
Yeah. It's just like there's something like just exactly right about how he ends up being in the movies. Like, you make a fair beater.
Yeah.
Which I was like, as I was like reading, I was like, does he say that in the book? Because I can't remember whether or not he does. Which of course I don't think he does in here.
Speaking of basketball though, this is another one of those just like silly wizard things where Harry's like, oh, that's like basketball, but I'm broomstick with six hoops. And he's like, what's basketball? And I'm like, are you telling me that wizard kids don't know any muggle sports at all? Like, it seems, of course, muggle kids can't know about Quidditch because that whole world's a secret. But like, sports are still a big, it doesn't track with me that wizards don't follow muggle sports at all.
It does, yeah. And you're right, because I do think the perspective shift is very different based on whether or not you're a wizard versus if you are a muggle. Because you're exactly right. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Like, the statute of secrecy dictates, and like primary objective of all wizard kind is basically to exist essentially like unbeknownst to the muggle world, the non-magical world. And, you know, but like that means, you know, I think like Hogsmeade is one of the only, you know, British exclusive wizard communities. Like, even Godric's Hollow, I've mentioned this before, is like has muggles that live there. So it's like you would have basic exposure just by existing kind of like quietly from within these
right populations. Like, even if you don't follow it, it seems hard to not know what basketball is, especially because not two paragraphs later he's throwing golf balls for Harry to catch as stand-in snitches. And it's like, okay, you have golf balls, which means you must know that those come from the muggle sport of golf. And golf is just much more obscure than basketball. So
Yeah. No, it does seem a little bit surprising. And I wrote that exact same note down as well, where it's like, well, he knows about the golf balls. But I suppose there's some world where he just has small white balls and has no idea what the sport of golf is.
Sure. I guess that's possible, that he's just like, these are conveniently sized.
Right. Yeah. This is about it. This is another one of those occasions like where, as you get further into the series and you learn more about like the Golden Snitch and some of the attached lore of the Snitch in particular, is that it seems like they are one-time use objects. Like they're like effectively like created for every single match, and because I mean they you know, like the one that Dumbledore will eventually give Harry is the one that he'll catch in his first ever match.
Yeah.
And that has like the flesh memory attached to it. So, you know who like wins the contested, bout or whatever, like who touched it first, which is also a little bit flawed logic because somebody could like nick it and just not catch it. But
right.
either which way, this is like one of those where it seems like the case contains what is otherwise like Hogwarts snitch.
Yeah, or it's like a training snitch or something. Maybe I guess it must be.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Like, what my honest opinion here is that the lore of the snitch had not been properly built out yet, and I'm not fussed about that.
Right.
But I would say at this point in the page, as these words were written down, I would suspect that it had not yet been concluded that every single snitch was unique in its own special way.
Yeah, I would pretty much agree with you on that as well. Moving on, he starts getting to the rules of the game where there are so many things about Quidditch that I love and so many things that I'm like, why this? Why is it that way? But the fact that I love the game design that catching the snitch ends the game, that there's not like a set time limit to it, so you could have very long games or very short games.
Yep.
That is so cool. But the 150 points is just too many. Like, it is just like, there's no way that it's, there's like, I mean, he says it right there, an extra 150 points, so they nearly always win. It just like, it makes it feel like the rest of the game, which is otherwise so cool, like, doesn't matter. It's just like, whoever catches the snitch pretty much gets it, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. It needs to be like 30 points and you end the game or something.
No, but it's interesting too, because I mean, like, later on we'll get like the, I think the record for the longest match is 3 months.
Yeah.
Keep bringing on substitutes so players could get some sleep, which is just flat out absurd. 3 months would be like far too long. People wouldn't be able to continue to spectate. It would just be like, and who are these like unbelievably inept seekers?
I know.
That, like, you know, the snitch can't leave the pitch area and they're just out there for months. They're just forever.
You know what the real problem is? I wrote this out on the other page, is that if you've got like, if you're a team, it has to have happened at some point in Hogwarts history where just like all of the beaters weren't very good. Or something. Like, it seems to me that if you're at, like, you know, middle school, high school age Quidditch, there's a lot of games that are severely dictated by the bludgers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and a couple of thoughts here, because one of the things I was going to say is that simply if the match lasted for 3 months, then 150 points is probably, like, null and void.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, and at that point, it's just like, just end the game, man. Right. Just like, I mean, come on.
The score could or would be in the thousands. The other is that Oliver Wood says, don't worry, the Weasleys are more than a match for the bludgers. I mean, they're a pair of human bludgers themselves. This is pretty high praise coming from Oliver Wood, who, you know, has just become Quidditch captain, and the Fred and George are only, are they in their third year?
Third year, yeah.
Their third year, which means that they've only played 1 year of Quidditch themselves so far. So, like, as second years, they not only made the team, but were good enough to get this kind of praise,
yeah,
which is pretty impressive. The other thing I was going to say, though, about the points is, they do come up in the standings as something that is otherwise somewhat important.
Yeah, that is true. That it's like, you know, we have to be up by this much and then catch the snitch. So it's sort of like if you can let your team, like, even if you could catch it right away, maybe it behooves you in the standings to let your team try and score like as many points as possible before you end the game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that could be like one of those where it's sort of like, you know, the general thought is that like, if you see the snitch, you catch the snitch, like let that be that. But right. I feel like that lends a little bit more credence to the thought, like, okay, like, I saw the snitch, but it's too early based on where we're at in the season. And if we want to be able to move up against this other team, then we have to, like, you know, I got to trust my chasers for a little while.
It seems that there could be some, like, seriously, like, ganging up on certain teams. Like, if you know that, like, Ravenclaw's put out a poor team this year and it's like, all right, guys, we're going to try to get to, like, 1,500 points this game.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Run it up as high as you can. And then, you know, Harry, you know, I'll give you if we get over 1,000, just try and catch it at that point. Cool.
Cool. But even if they catch it at that point in time, we'll be fine.
Yeah, we're good because we're just going to focus on chasing this game. So you just block their seeker, all right? They got a Comet 260. They're flashy, but not in the same league as the Nimbus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, that gets us through, I think, most of Quidditch for the most part, right? Do you have any other thoughts on that before we kind of move on to the next major? Because this is almost like two chapters in one chapter.
There is a little bit. There's like the Quidditch half and then the Halloween half. There is just the note that Charlie Weasley says he could have played for England if he hadn't gone off chasing dragons. And it's like, I'm really surprised Charlie doesn't go to play Quidditch, because like it always like when they have the World Cup, it makes it seem like all these different countries have these like deep leagues with extremely professional Quidditch players. But then you have Oliver Wood, who is by all accounts an amazing Quidditch player, and it's on like the B team for what, like England
or Puddlemere United,
which doesn't even sound like the Premier League team or something.
Right.
It's like he's, you know, backup on a backup team or something. It's like the pool for recruitment for professional Quidditch teams is not very big because there's only one school in England, you know?
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Like, where are they recruiting all their Quidditch players from? Like, most of the English players must be from Hogwarts, you know? And it's not just England, because it's like there's a team for England and a team for Wales and a team for Ireland. So like and probably one for Scotland then. So like those four countries all are reaping players from one school's worth of talent. And it's like, no wonder they're not very good or getting thumped by Transylvania or something.
Right, you know? Right, right. Which I think is who they lose to when they're at the World Cup. Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. Yeah, I think that's probably, because I mean, yeah, you've effectively got at any given point in time, you know, Hogwarts, who has four teams each with about seven players. So,
yeah,
you know, there's effectively like 28 players being trained every 7 years.
Yeah, and it's not like 28 players are graduating every year because they're not all seventh years.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So like maybe on like a good year, like 14 new potential players exit Hogwarts. But you got to think, out of 14, not all 14 of them are like pro quality. You know, what I'm saying is the pro Quidditch teams really can't be that picky, or, you know, about who they're fielding.
Unless it's just the case that like the people who make the school Quidditch teams are the cream of the crop. But then you've also got like, you know, Cormac McLaggen, who never ends up actually like truly being on the team for any significant length of time, but probably could go on to play professionally, or like Seamus, you know.
Sure, I guess,
you know.
But then you have the Oliver Wood problem, being like on the backup squad for Puddlemere.
Well, this is true.
You know, this is true.
Although, to be fair, this is the other thing too, because this is the point I was going to bring up, is that he says, I wouldn't be surprised if he turned out to be better than Charlie Weasley, and he could have played for England. It's like Charlie, isn't it the case that, or is it just the House Cup? Is it the House Cup that they've lost for like so many years to Slytherin?
They've lost like 7 years in a row to Slytherin, yeah.
But just the House Cup, but not the Quidditch Cup?
Not the Quidditch Cup.
Okay. So maybe it's like the big question is, if Charlie was so good, then like surely Gryffindor must have been winning the Quidditch Cup.
Yeah,
they were never bottom of the table. We know that much.
We know that, yeah. They haven't finished fourth in over a century.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, I don't have a grand explanation there. But again, I feel like I've brought this up a couple of times, but Charlie is super prominent in book one. But then I feel like Charlie gets to own like the first half of Harry's experience in terms of like the Weasley references. And then Bill pretty much takes over.
The second half. He gets a whole wedding. It's a whole affair.
It's a Mary Fleur.
Mary's Fleur de la Cour. Yeah,
man. Amazing stuff. Anyway, On to Halloween. Yes. There's an interesting little tidbit here that I always find kind of fascinating, because whenever you're reading the story, it always comes across as if like Harry is basically having eventful day after eventful day after eventful day. And you know, it's like every bit you follow, it's sort of like Snape is always picking on him. Malfoy is always being a problem. Seamus is always doing whatever, you know, like it's always something. And then we get one sentence just says, Harry could hardly believe when he realized that he'd already been at Hogwarts for 2 months.
Right.
This is like one of those moments where like the story just takes like one great big step forward.
Yeah.
Because otherwise these books would be like 3,000 pages long.
Basically it was like, and then Harry went to school and had classes like usual for 2 weeks.
Yes.
And it's Halloween. Yeah.
And then it's Halloween. So time has changed. The other important note here is that like you don't get like a great scope of how much the relationship between Hermione and Harry and Ron has been sort of like, you know, wedged. But like this sort of like notion that 2 months had passed means that like from the midnight duel until the events of Halloween, like they've basically been like cold shouldering each other completely, like and just completely not getting along. So
yeah. So then it also feels like, okay, that's a very long time for Hermione to have really not had any friends at school too.
That's also true. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So then we get to a charms class where they're learning Wingardium Leviosa, which surprising to me that 2 months in they haven't done this spell to float feathers, but. Nonetheless.
Well, Jay, I mean, as Flitwick points out, Wizard Baruffio, who said S instead of F and found himself on the floor with a buffalo on his chest.
Ben, I have so many fun facts about Baruffio the wizard.
You lay them all on me.
Yeah, because I was like, first of all, I was like, what spell was he trying to do that the missing, that saying like F instead of S ended up summoning a buffalo onto his chest? I don't know which, because we don't know what the buffalo summoning charm is or whatever he was trying to do. But it obviously wasn't Wingardium Leviosa, because that doesn't have any F's in it. So
what yeah. doesn't make sense to me is that he specifically said S instead of F, and
yes.
found himself on the floor with a buffalo, a word that notably has F's in it and no S's in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did he say?
I have no idea, but apparently in the French version of Harry Potter, this paragraph goes a little bit differently, because whoever was like doing the dub was like trying to play with some alliteration.
Okay.
But after you translate it from French, it says, "Remember Wizard Baruffio, who had a speech impediment and whose wife was left with a buffalo on her shoulders instead of a mink." So they like mess it around a little bit, but it introduces Baruffio's mix up as the result of a stutter rather than, or as a part of a speech impediment, instead of just like a mistake. So that I thought was pretty interesting. But then also Baruffio comes up later as the creator of Baruffio's brain elixir.
Yes.
Which is something that they are, someone tries to sell it to Ron in his fifth year as a way to get like better grades on their OWLs.
Yeah.
But apparently, or if you go look on Potter, the Wikipedia, Baruffio's brain elixir did not work at all and posed serious health hazards if improperly brewed. So it seems like Baruffio is most famous for making an ineffective potion that does the exact opposite of what it says, and for summoning a buffalo either on himself or his wife's chest by mispronouncing a word. But then interestingly, despite the fact that Baruffio's brain elixir doesn't have a good reputation in the text, there is also, do you remember I'm sure you do.
Yeah, Wizards Unite.
Wizards Unite.
Yeah.
In Wizards Unite, Baruffio's brain elixir was like an experience multiplying potion, which made it like one of the best potions in the game.
That was honestly, like, I got to this sentence, and this is like one of those moments in like, you know, in the books where I was just like, I've read these books so many times, and for whatever reason, this entire fragment has never stood out to me before. Like as I'm like reading through it for the show, I was like, I've never read this sentence before in my entire life. Like, and but then all of a sudden it's like, but surely I have.
Yeah.
You know, and which is just so, this would be a question on like a trivia, you know, stream or Jay versus Ben Ryback. I have literally no idea. But hopefully now Baruffio will be baked into my brain.
Yeah, you got
forever.
It. You yeah. got it now.
Moving on just slightly from that paragraph though, this is sort of like an interesting little tidbit that I always find to be kind of hilarious about the first book, is that it says, it was very difficult. Harry and Seamus swished and flicked, but the feather they were supposed to be sending skyward just lay on the desktop. This is just about as close, other than like when Harry purchases his wand, this is as close as we ever get to Harry performing a spell in the entire first book.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like it feels like, you know, you get to see him like enter the wizarding world. You get to see him experiencing all these first, you know, having his first chocolate frog and Bertie Bott's every flavored bean.
Right. And he does some accidental magic. He makes the glass disappear and he flies the broom and stuff like that.
Right. Exactly. But like, you would think that like the moment that he casts his first spell would be his own, like a chapter dedicated to it, like this like remarkable sensation of you know, the magic channeling through yeah. him and his relationship with his wand.
Instead, no. Yeah. Most of his relationship with magic in the first book is like his interaction with magical objects.
Yes.
Like
yes.
flying on the broom, catching the Remember-All, using the invisibility cloak, looking at the Mirror of Erised.
You know? Right, right. Yeah. So he interacts with tons of magical things.
Yeah.
But he never actually like successfully, at least on page.
Cast a spell. Yeah.
Which, you know, it's just that you got to bring it up. Then you, of course, got the rather infamous or famous at that rate, Wingardium Leviosa. You know, it's.
Oh, yeah. I circled that whole exchange. It's that just wrote, like, who knew how popular this exchange would be?
Oh, yeah. My gosh. I know. Yeah. Like, this has been made into just like every single punified version of t-shirt. You know?
Yes.
Like, if you go to Universal Studios and you're walking through Diagon Alley, like, you'll see somebody's wearing a Wingardium Leviosa.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Just one of the best scenes in the movies. And really sets up the second half of the chapter where Hermione is correcting Ron on how to do it. And then, of course, she correctly does it. So that's the worst, when someone's like correcting you and you're like hating them for it, but then like they're succeeding and it's like, want to listen to you.
That's exactly
even though clearly I need to.
Yep. This is another one of those kind of like the crush scene from earlier. This is like such a classic high school moment where somebody is just genuinely got some talent in a specific topic, like they're excelling at something, and it's like you may resentfully have to sort of take their advice, but like it's like I would rather do it wrong.
I'd rather do it than
accept the way.
I'd rather do it wrong.
nailed it.
Speaking of whom, the next page, uncharacteristically mean, is Ron, where Hermione is crying and Harry says, "I think she heard you," and he says, "So."
Yeah, but so,
she must have noticed she's got no friends. Like, oh, savage Ron.
It does have the decency to say, said Ron, but he looked a bit uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I think that this is another relatable middle school, high school moment. Like I've said before, I think middle schoolers are probably amongst like the most potentially... What is the best way to describe it? Like
perceptive.
They're highly perceptive, but they don't have like the decency nor like the own personal experience of being on the receiving end of negative comments to filter themselves at all. And so it's like as you're reaching this stage where you have like your like social life is becoming a thing for real. Like elementary school has social life and kids are like mean to one another, but that's usually more out of basic jealousy, you know, or like I have this toy, I don't want to share this toy with you, like
that are like reactional emotions.
Exactly. Yeah. But like I think once you reach middle school, you finally reach the stage where you're like able to be mean. Everybody's in like a very awkward like in between phase where they're not really a kid anymore, but they haven't really become an adult yet. It's like it's a difficult and complex age, and this stood out to me in particular, specifically because of that one phrase, because it says, "So," said Ron, but he looked a bit uncomfortable. This to me is almost like Ron being like, "No, I have decided that this person is my adversary," but like also like I think he's having like a small pang of guilt,
he's like testing the waters with being mean.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly. But it's like, but he doesn't like the feeling of making somebody cry. Is what I want to interpret.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Yeah, Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Griffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish, but that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped because like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As we scroll down a little bit here, though, we of course learn, from Parvati and Lavender that Hermione's crying in the girls' bathroom, which will is a little bit of, set up for how they'll know where to go as the scene unfolds a little bit more. Mm-hmm. The next one that sort of stood out to me, though, is they're there for the Halloween feast, where there's, thousands of live bats flying around the ceiling and all the rest. But it said the feast appeared suddenly on the golden plates as it had at the start of term banquet. This is kind of interesting because it means that the food doesn't always magically appear.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I wrote that down too, just said like, wait, is this not always the case? And I think what it means is that like for like a feast, they will have all of the plates and stuff just like laid out for everyone in advance. And then like all at once, they're just like a boom, massive amount of food. Whereas like, I think if you come down to breakfast, there's like, you probably just take a plate and there's a plate of sausages. And I'm sure the food magically appeared there, but it wasn't like a big like, event.
We're not using the fine gold plates.
Exactly.
Every single day. Yeah. I got you. That makes sense. Because otherwise,
not that Harry is reaching for anything fancy, Ben. He's still going for that baked potato.
For the baked potato in the wonderful magical world. No. The only note I had about that in particular was like, if in the event that it's not always magicked up there, it can't be being delivered by house elves, which we know are the people who work in the kitchens, because they don't know about the house elves until year four.
Yeah, like they haven't seen them at all. So I think they are still magically sending them up. They're just not like, it's not like a huge to-do.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Less of the pomp and circumstance there. Okay, right. I'm totally fine with that. Then we've got the scene where Quirrell comes racing into the Great Hall.
Iconic,
absolutely. This is like one of my favorite clips to use from, the movies in our SCB videos, but it's just the troll in the dungeons. I thought you ought to know.
Yes.
That he really demonstrates his spectacular acting abilities.
Yeah,
because what we'll eventually learn is that Quirrell is quite good with trolls.
He is quite good with trolls. Even this is quite the performance as well. Because like clearly he doesn't actually. Well, I don't think he actually faints. And he's lying about where the troll is because the troll is not in the dungeons. It's like up on the near the third floor.
Yeah, this is like one of those things where it's like the fact that. Everybody leaves the Great Hall. All the kids are supposed to be going back to their dormitories. And like the teachers somehow don't find, maybe what happens is that like the teachers listen to Quirrell, take him at face value and go to the dungeons.
Well, I think that's what he's hoping, that he's like, let me send as many teachers as possible as far away from where I want to go as possible.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. That makes more sense because what he's trying to do is get through.
Yeah, because he wants to go try and get past Fluffy.
That's exactly it. Yeah. You're right. So he's definitely sending him on a fool's errand.
Yeah.
In the meantime, though, we then know that Harry and Ron are now, of course, concerned because Hermione does not know because she's in the girls' bathroom and not at the feast. And so then they're sort of like, okay, we're going to have to go and look for her.
Right.
And,
let her know.
We can't have her face a troll completely on her own, which ends up being great instincts because it turns out exactly where she is where the troll is as well.
Yep. Classic instincts by Harry. Also, before we get to that, this is something I wrote down, which I think we should address, is that as far as all the teachers know, the troll is in the dungeon. And Dumbledore is like, all right, prefix, take your students back to your common rooms. And not for nothing, but the Slytherin common room is in the dungeons.
Oh, true. Yep.
So he's just like, all right, Slytherins, you're good. Go to the dungeons. It's fine. That's where the troll is. Don't worry about it. It's good.
Just if you see it, just go the other way.
And then I know when they're watching the troll, that even sees Snape going, he's clearly going to cut off Quirrell or whatever in this moment. But like even Snape, who is the head of Slytherin House, isn't in the dungeon with his students where apparently the troll is.
Right. But I mean, and again, to be fair, we know that we know Snape in particular is specifically like being told by Dumbledore to keep an eye on Quirrell at this stage in the process. So it stands to reason that probably what happened was everybody exited the Great Hall. Snape, watching Quirrell, knowing that Quirrell is up to no good, saw him stand up and race off in the other direction and then chased him that way as well. What the thing I thought you were going to mention here is that Harry and Ron hear somebody coming and they think it's Percy, so they hide behind a large stone griffin, which of course, you know, is the namesake here of our podcast.
That's true.
The Gryffindor.
Does that mean they're hiding right outside the headmaster's office?
They are indeed.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's my interpretation. No,
it pretty much has to be it, yeah.
Yeah. So from there, though, obviously I find this to be sort of like an interesting turn of events, or I don't know, like the writing maybe feels like just a tiny bit clunky because they're specifically heading in this direction to find Hermione in the bathroom so that they can warn her about the troll. And basically they start to smell the stench of the troll itself, watch it enter into a room.
Right.
I guess, which maybe they don't know what room it is, but just a room. The room itself has a key already in the lock.
Yep.
Which is kind of like a strange one because it's like if you were going to the restroom, it seems like the key would be on the inside for the person in the restroom,
yes,
not on the outside where somebody could just, especially
lock
students,
you in.
Lock you in. Yeah. It's like, that seems silly. But so Harry, being ever brave, jumps forward and locks the troll inside of this room. At this point in time, flushed with their victory, they started to run back up the passage. Ah, nailed it. But as they reach the corner, they hear something that made their heart stop. They were going in this direction to find Hermione in the bathroom, the very room that they just locked the troll inside of. Upon locking the troll inside of the room, they run away.
Yeah.
It's like they've like abandoned. I mean, maybe it's just like the fact that the troll is there. It's like, all right, sorry, Hermione. Like we gotta get out of here.
Yeah. Probably she's not. Maybe she's not. But the thing is, like, yeah, like they realize that the troll is going into the bathroom, right? Because that's the room they were going to. Presumably.
That's my thought as well. Yeah.
Right. And you're right. Why is there a key in the door? And also, what do you think the key is going to do to stop the troll from getting out?
Right. It feels like the troll probably can just punch the
door. The troll can just punch the door right through. I mean, because I don't think locking the door makes a difference to the troll.
Probably not.
Having a closed door is one thing, I guess. Maybe that will deter it. But it seems like locking it is like the extra step. All they really do is truly trap Hermione in a bad situation.
Yes, in fact they do. So anyway, they wheel around and discover that, of course, Hermione is now trapped inside of the bathroom with the troll, at which point Harry and Ron sort of do, you know, kind of what Harry, Ron, and Hermione will ultimately do pretty much all throughout the series, which is just doing something that is both like admirable but also equal parts reckless.
Yeah.
You know, so they demonstrate like a little bit of their bravery. They immediately jump into action where, you know, it's like, okay, like we can't let Hermione be hurt by the troll. We must save her.
Right.
At what point in time, you know, so you're to get that like neat piece of symmetry where now Ron is using the advice on behalf of Hermione to save Hermione.
Right. Even though, but she only needs saving because of things he said to her.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like this nice sort of like circle. And then it's like she's only trapped in there because they trapped her in there.
Yes. So this is literally what I wrote at the end of the chapter was, I love the almost rock, paper, scissors dynamic the trio has in this particular chapter. None of them are exactly faultless, but together they can all overcome each other's shortcomings.
Yeah.
It's sort of like each of them is sort of like both, in the same way that rock, paper, scissors works, it's like they're all like they're completing exactly that, like a circle.
Right.
It's like they all sort of have like a fault that causes something else to happen, that causes a strength to happen, that causes a strength to happen, that causes a strength to happen. Like, and then they can sort of like orbit each other and like balance each other out, so to speak.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, Harry jumping on the back of the troll is like the thing where I'm like, well, that was that ever hoping to do? Was that ever going to work?
Right.
But then really Ron, you know, is kind of the hero of the moment here.
Ron is the hero. Well, I also like, as soon as they get in there, it's like they walk in the room and immediately Harry is just like, confuse it. And it's like it's the first time Harry's like really like in his element, like I'm problem solving in a dark magic situation.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is just, it's just a troll in the bathroom, but like he does immediately like assume the role of like the leader and like start barking orders at like Ron, who's just like immediately starts doing what he says. And
right.
like, they do get to the bottom of it, which is good. But what I love about this particular passage is that, so if you watch the movie, the way this goes down is that Harry's, you know, choke holding the troll or something, sticking his wand up its nose very effectively. And Ron is over there and Hermione like coaches him through it. She says, swish and flick. And then Ron does it and like knocks out the troll. But in the book, what actually happens is that Hermione cowers in fear and Ron does it all by himself. End of story.
Yeah, this is, it seemed like this was like a classic like film decision, which was that like they take a lot of moments where like Ron actually does like manage to shine through a little bit. And again, like, you know, we we're kind of far off from really like delving into it too much, but like Ron's wand here is actively like working against him, at least if you like dig deep into the lore, like, you know, right. that his particular wand wood and core, like that he because he has his brother Charlie's wand, which again, my theory is that because Charlie went to study dragons, he created his own wand, or at the very least harvested his own dragon heartstring,
sure,
that he then was able to use for his new wand.
That's
my particular thought as to why Charlie would choose a new wand at all, which most of the time is not necessary, but like this is like one of those things where like Ron's like inability to perform good magic for his first couple of years is in large part due to the fact that he is fighting against a wand that does not want to work properly for him. So kind of a big win for him, because he not only is like under extreme pressure, has not successfully done this spell before, but is also, you know, dealing with the sort of wand that's tying one hand behind his back. So he pulls it off, they knock out the troll, and we start to get the setup here for the arrival of all of the, you know, professors, where Quirrell continues his spectacular acting. It says Quirrell took one look at the troll, let out a faint whimper, and sat down quickly on a toilet, clutching his heart.
It is good misdirect here, because he could be just acting, or he could be like, you know, he could be reacting in this exact way because he's upset that his plan failed.
That,
you know,
that's
like he's
true.
Afraid of Voldemort is what he's actually afraid of right now.
Yes, absolutely. But what I find kind of interesting about this is that, like, then Hermione sort of like steps in, and she sort of like starts to, at least what is described as a lie, but it says, please, Professor McGonagall, they were looking for me. I went looking for the troll because I thought I could deal with it on my own, you know, because I've read all about them. And so like that portion of it is a lie.
Yeah.
Like Hermione was crying because of them in the first place. But otherwise, the rest of this is actually reasonably accurate. They were looking for her.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah,
like,
that part is true.
Yeah. That's like exactly, you know, if they hadn't found me, I'd be dead now. And it's like, that's also true. Harry stuck his wand up its nose. Ron knocked it out with his own club. That's also true.
Also true.
You know, they didn't have time to catch anyone. It was about to finish me off when they arrived. Also true.
Yep.
But it says Harry and Ron looked as though this story wasn't new to them. It's like, guys, that is very nearly what just happened.
Right, yeah.
You know, the underlying reason why Hermione is in the bathroom is the only piece of the story that's actually been changed at all.
Right, yeah, that she went to go hunt it down by herself.
Yeah.
There's also when Snape arrives there, it says Snape gave Harry a swift, piercing look, which I was like, I just made note of. I was like, did he do like a quick legilimens on him in that moment? Like, what happened? Like, can I read it from your mind? Like, can he go like just confirm with Dumbledore later, like, here's what happened, Professor?
Well,
or something.
If that's the case, it almost feels like this is again a situation where it's the same as like Ron sort of like resentfully taking Hermione's advice on something, because what Snape would see is that Harry and Ron did successfully show up and did successfully save Hermione.
Yeah. You know what though? This sentence, as I'm thinking about it, is almost a little clue that Snape is not the villain either.
Because
when Harry first gets there at the Great Hall and like locks eyes with Snape, that's when his scar hurts.
Yes.
And this is them doing it again. Snape gave Harry a swift, piercing look, and then Harry looked at the floor. So it sounds like they locked eyes. And then he like looked away, but his scar does not hurt this time.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I guess you could have maybe pieced that together, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, that's very interesting. But I do like your legitimacy thought as well, because I feel like that's something that like, once you know that Snape's had this ability the whole time, it's like, you have to imagine that this is just like like Snape is constantly wanting to catch Harry in the act,
right?
But he knows Harry is always breaking the rules because he can just read Harry's mind and know that he's doing it,
right?
So that certainly seems to be the case. This is like another one of those interesting moments, though, from McGonagall, where she deducts 5 points from Miss Granger only to give the points back to Ron and Harry.
Yeah,
sort of like an interesting like ledger that she's holding. It's like, well, that's 5 points from you. Now 5 points to both of you.
And right.
It's like, it's almost like one of those things where she could have just awarded them both 5 points, like as a collective, like right. Ron, you have earned 5 points or whatever. But I don't know. Yeah. I think it's kind of the point system again continues to be like a little bit interesting here.
Yeah. It also just seems like 5 points isn't enough to be, it seems like she should have taken more from, it just seems like maybe it all would have evened out the same, but it also just feels like five isn't enough to have taken from Hermione, and it's not enough to have awarded Harry and Ron.
Yeah. This goes back to like the first year thing, though, where it's like, I wonder if on some level, like, you know, in everyday, like, because I mean, we know that they take like single points from first year. So
yeah.
It's like, is 5 points almost like the maximum you could or could not award, shy of being the headmaster who was able to just hand out 50s as...
Well, no, because McGonagall takes 50 points from three of them later on, so
it could be more.
Yeah, and that's just for being out of bed, right? When she takes it from the next time,
right? This seems worse.
Yeah,
or better.
This seems worse and better.
Yeah,
so it doesn't seem like the five is unusual here at this point. And Ron complains about the same thing. He says we should have gotten more than 10 points. I'm like, I'm with you, man.
Yeah, I totally agree. So anyway, though, yeah, as we trudge forward, though, the fun and kind of exciting end to this particular chapter is the phrase, but from that moment on, Hermione Granger became their friend. There are some things you can't share without ending up liking each other, and knocking out a 12-foot mountain troll is one of them.
I know.
I love it. The Golden Trio has been formed, and it took more than half the book to get
it
there.
It really does. Yeah, now we're at chapter 11, and finally Hermione is part of the group proper.
Yes. Jeez. So it's very interesting. What I also find to be kind of interesting about how Hermione has been like portrayed up until this point is it's not like, you know how like it's almost the case that like all Slytherins are like pig-headed or you know, like they all have like names that seem kind of like harsh,
just like rude or something. Yeah.
It's like Hermione has not exactly been depicted out of character so far. This is almost more like a matter of allegiance, because I feel like Hermione stays pretty true to even how we've seen her up until this point. Like, following rules continues to be something that's important to her. She continues to be, you know, like more knowledgeable, or, you know, if you want to call her a know-it-all, moving forward. But like, it's sort of like the underlying way in which she now interacts with the other has this like respect involved.
Right.
So I think it's actually pretty well crafted for Hermione, you know, up until this point, you know.
Yeah. It's like, she's finally able to like check herself, and it's like, there are times where breaking the rules is the right thing to do.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So
yeah, well, it's worth it to lie on their behalf because they saved my life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So very exciting stuff. Golden Trio has been forged.
Yay.
And that'll round off chapter 10, Halloween for us.
It will. That will round it off. What did you think of the chapter art for this chapter, Ben?
Oh,
it is, if we go back to the front, the first page here, it's basically just the troll dragging his club around. I mean, I thought it looks pretty much exactly like the chapter describes it, but I always think in this particular chapter art, he looks just like kind of happy. Like
the troll does look like a little bit more lovable, maybe, then like you would sort of imagine a troll to be. I also always sort of love, and I mean, I don't know, I have no idea why, but like, you know, when Harry gets like the troll bogeys, you know, on his wand, it says, I think that he like wipes it off on the troll's trousers. And this, I have literally no idea what fascinates me so much about the fact that like within the troll community, as like, you know, dim as they may be, they have still been able to like fashion garments.
Yeah, they still have pants.
They still have pants.
Or whatever.
And
also,
I know.
I was just noticing the vest for the first time as I'm looking at it. Like, this troll really got dressed. I mean, he is wearing pants with a belt, even, like, went as far as that. And then not only put on a shirt, but also added the vest.
Right. I mean, like, that's fashion.
This guy is like,
he's layering.
I know. He's like, it's an occasion. It's Halloween. I'm about to go torment a castle. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he's layering. Yeah. So no wonder he looks like he's in such a good mood. It's like, I like the chapter art of this one. It's fun.
I like the chapter art. Yeah, it's a good one. And I am also very excited as we turn the page and look forward to chapter 11, which will be titled Quidditch.
Oh, I know. I always love the Quidditch matches in the books. Like, it's very fun reading what's happening. Like, just I get invested in the games.
Exactly. It'll be curious to see how it plays out from like an analysis standpoint. Mm-hmm. Though, is there as much to take away from the Quidditch chapter? We'll have to wait and see.
We shall have to wait and see. Would you like to hear a review?
I would love to.
Excellent. All right. So we got a review just yesterday as I'm reading this from SharkAttack117.
Nice.
I know. Five stars. They said, absolutely phenomenal. Hey, brother. Love your show on YouTube. Amazing podcast. I have a suggestion for What If. What if Barty Crouch was able to get to Dumbledore? You guys are the best voice for commentating Harry Potter and a lot of other stuff too on your show. Also, I drive Uber and this podcast has really helped me stay focused and listen to something while I drive. It's amazing to hear your thoughts. I wish I was able to contribute some of my own thoughts on the Harry Potter world. So, one, I love that whoever gets in your Uber has to listen to this podcast.
That's amazing. Thank you for spreading the word.
Yes.
Great way to do it.
Yes. And great what if, as what if Barty Crouch had gotten to Dumbledore? Because it's like, in many ways, there's almost no reason he couldn't have just, I mean, he's around Dumbledore all the time. Skipping ahead a little with Goblet of Fire.
It's a very good question because, I mean, this is sort of like one of those moments where, like, the like, you know, the phrase like, you know, don't shoot the messenger or whatever, but in this case the messenger does not make it, and Barty Crouch Jr. has sort of like turned the tide on his father, you know, who is then now sort of like kind of like just lost in the, you know, the Forbidden Forest.
I was reading this question as if what if Barty Crouch Jr. had been able to like kill Dumbledore, but I suppose the question is what if Barty Crouch Sr. had been able to like tell Dumbledore that Barty Crouch Jr. had escaped and was alive. Ooh. Oh man, that is a much better question. Okay.
It's a great question. Yeah. No. It's certainly something that I think you could delve into pretty aggressively to be like, because the big question in sort of like when we go into some of the facets of like Dumbledore's big plan, mm-hmm, and everything to do with how Dumbledore is like constantly like really aware of everything that's happening in the castle. I mean, even what we know eventually from Deathly Hallows is that from the very beginning, you know, of the school year, Dumbledore tells Snape, keep an eye on Quirrell for me, won't you? Which basically suggests that like throughout the whole first book, Dumbledore knows he has a double agent living, breathing, teaching in his school.
Right. Like I would suspect he doesn't know as much as Voldemort is living on the back of his head.
He's more like generally suspicious. I mean, Harry speculates at the end of this very novel that we're reading right now that, you know, I feel like Dumbledore knows everything that goes on inside these walls, you know, to some extent or another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which again is a very curious thought as to like how much does he know?
I don't think he knows everything. Like, he certainly has no idea how Sirius Black is breaking into the castle in a few years.
That's true. And he does seem genuinely shocked that Mad-Eye Moody. And maybe this is like one of those things where like Dumbledore has so much faith in Mad-Eye as a wizard, you know, inside of book four that he doesn't think to question, you know, the possibility that he could have been like overtaken.
Yeah. Like Voldemort's trying to use Dumbledore's like ability to trust people against him.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, it's particularly interesting because I mean, it would ward off at the very least the fact that Moody is the one who takes the cup to the middle of the maze.
I guess they still wouldn't know it's Moody, would he? Even if he knew Barty Crouch Jr. was like loose.
True.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that he would even like be able to sniff it out.
Right.
But he would be suspicious of the fact that somehow, some way, somebody, you know, was able to get Harry's name inside of the goblet.
Right.
You know, and that's the type of thing.
Almost certainly is aware that Barty Crouch Jr. is the culprit for the Goblet of Fire.
Yes.
Yeah. And then it's like, but how did he get into the school? Like, he must have been there. He must be there somehow.
But then this is like where it's like you have to credit Dumbledore's wisdom enough with the thought of he's able to suss out a lot of things.
Yeah.
Who's new this year?
Right, exactly. So, yeah. But then it's like there's all those like Karkaroffs there, you know.
True.
Like he is investigating Karkaroff and Ludo Bagman and stuff at the same time. So it's like, was it one of them? Is one of them? Yeah, I guess, yeah, could he... Yeah, what do you think Polyjuice Potion was at play? I don't know. I guess he could put... If he put, like, Snape on alert that someone was making Polyjuice... Because Snape realizes that Polyjuice Potion ingredients are stolen from him.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah, so it'd be like... Does he go to Dumbledore with that information? I can't remember.
I don't know. He complains to Harry about it.
He does, yeah. Like, swing flies, boom, sling
someone
skin.
Someone is making Polyjuice Potion.
Feels possible. Again, this is like where you don't assume that Snape would necessarily be telling everything to Dumbledore, but when you know that Dumbledore is acting alongside Snape so directly, it's like, it seems very possible that they might be having meetings that be like... Someone's stealing Polyjuice Potion.
Yeah. Well, this what if... Okay, so this what if really goes back to... So if Barty Crouch Jr. had been able to get to Dumbledore, it's because... If Barty Crouch Sr. had been able to tell Dumbledore, like, that would have happened if Barty Crouch Jr. didn't have the map. Right? Like, the reason he's able to interfere is because he has taken the Marauder's map from Harry.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The real question is, what if he doesn't take the map? Because then Harry still has the map... And would know that Barty Crouch Jr. is the bad guy, maybe.
Yeah, we're gonna.
Who knows?
We're gonna need to go spend more time with it. Anyway, yeah. It's a great question. Who was our reviewer here?
Shark? I don't know. It's a Shark Attack 117.
Shark Attack 117. Amazing, yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for a very thoughtful question. I mean, we got to just keep a lookout because I feel like this could certainly be a video sometime.
I know it could be.
Yeah, that's a good one to break down. And I'm surprised. It's amazing to me that as it always is with the Wizarding World, that we keep finding new ways to discuss the story.
I know. So, yeah, very fun.
But anyway, guys, thank you so much. As ever, and until next time,
we will see you through the Gryffindor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.